Back together again, you and I, Monday, brand new week, February 26th, 2024, on Connecticut Today. I kicked it off with my thoughts about the suspect currently being held in connection with the death of a Georgia nursing student. Landmark Legal Foundation lawyer and analyst Mike O'Neill analyzed a major social media case now being heard at the U.S. Supreme Court, while Connecticut News Junkie and Substack.com columnist and blogger Terry Cowgill stopped by with his weekly update.
All right, so the last thing I want to hear today from anybody, anybody local, anybody statewide, anybody on the national scene, the last thing I want to hear, because if I hear it again, my head's going to explode. The last thing I want to hear is, well, we shouldn't turn the death of this nursing student in Georgia into a political football. You're damn right we should. Well, you know, it was a tragedy, and this undocumented migrant, no, this illegal, bludgeons this girl to death because she's on her way out, or she's in the middle of a jog a few days ago. And all of a sudden, and man, you can set your watch by it, when this sort of stuff happens, well, this is going to play right into the Republicans' xenophobic mantra. Oh, shut up. No, you know what it's going to show? That we can't get our heads out of our rear ends, no matter what proctologist we call, about this issue. So, yeah, I want this to become a dirty, nasty, seething, dripping, oozing, filthy political issue. I do, because if we don't talk about it now, when in hell are we going to talk about it? And, you know, you get these stories every so often when, whether it's a drunk driver or somebody shooting, illegals kill people all the time. And I mention that to front of my, you know, to some of my left-leaning friends. I go, well, the fact that the person was an illegal or an undocumented has nothing to do with the crime itself. I actually get that from friends of mine. But, folks, come on. When are we going to straighten this out? When are we going to straighten this out? Now, this I can't wait for. Coming up in this Thursday, I think it is, all of a sudden, Joe Biden's going to go to the border. All of a sudden. Ah, son of a gun, huh? He finally read his poll numbers. All of a sudden, Joe Biden's going to go to the border. And he's going to get there, and he's going to stumble and stammer about how Republicans are the fault. Really, Mr. President? Really? You took over office, and you reversed just about everything. Now, not everything was perfect, but you reversed a lot of the stuff that was kind of working under the Trump years. But you pandered and said you were going to reverse that, and now look what happened. 200, 250, 300,000 migrant encounters at the border every day. Now, it's going to be interesting because Joe Biden and Donald Trump are going to be down there at the same time or near the same time on the border on Thursday. And you're already hearing, well, you know, folks are wondering what Donald Trump's going to say, and will he use the death of this Lake and Riley for brazen political purposes? You're sure as hell right he's going to, and as well he should. From the New York Post, the illegal immigrant arrested for killing a Georgia nursing student crossed the border into Texas on September 8th of last year. September 8th, 2023, and was sent to a processing facility there, but was quickly released before being put on a bus to New York City, where he was later arrested and set free again. This is according to his wife. Jose Antonio Ibarra and his wife, Leiling Franco of Venezuela, entered El Paso together with her 5-year-old son, she said. The family was sent to the Big Apple September 15th, where Ibarra posted smiling, carefree pictures of himself on social media in Times Square and in Rockefeller Center. Ibarra was working for DoorDash, Uber Eats, and a local restaurant when he was arrested in August for endangering the welfare of a child after he was caught in Queens riding a gas-powered moped with Franco's son on the back without any head protection or restraint for the child, according to police sources. The case was later sealed. So here you have a guy, obviously, with no smarts, here illegally. And by the way, illegals working for DoorDash, Uber Eats, and a restaurant, shame on all of you. Shame on all of you for hiring illegals, and I don't care whether it's run by a Democrat or especially a Republican. And believe me, a lot of Republicans, a lot of right-leaning companies, they like the cheap labor. Ibarra was working for DoorDash, Uber Eats, and a local restaurant when he was arrested in August for endangering the welfare of a child. The case was later sealed. Why is the case sealed? Can somebody... maybe they don't want people to know that an illegal was arrested. Folks, I'm sorry. I've had it. I have absolutely had it. This guy, if this guy was not in the country, with or without his wife and her kid, this young woman, this young nursing student in Georgia, Lakin Riley, would more than likely be alive today. And I have a serious question for you. And anytime you'd like to weigh in on this, no matter how you feel, we'll have a discussion on it. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Now, you may be one of the people out there who criticizes the way I talk about immigration and what happens with illegals and asylum seekers. Let me ask you a simple question. If you think that I and other conservatives and some moderates are wrong on immigration, that we should not simply allow people to come in and then be released, what if that young woman who was killed a few days ago in Georgia was your daughter? What if she was your granddaughter? What if she was your niece? What if she was your goddaughter? What if she was the girl who went away to college who lives next door to me, or her family lives across the street? Would you still think about it the same way? Would you, if you tend to be very progressive on immigration, just let these people in, we'll process them. So, okay, I'm asking you a fair question. Would you still be as opening and as welcoming? And again, I understand this is not every migrant. That's not what I'm saying. But it happens a lot. It just doesn't get play in the news here. And I know some of you would probably say, yeah, but you're blowing this out of proportion. Am I? Am I really? Because whenever it comes to guns, what do we hear? And let me draw a political parallel here, if I can. Whenever it comes to guns, and the gun lobbies and the gun clubs and the NRA say, hey, you know, the vast majority of legal gun owners are fine, which they are. What does the left always say, the progressive left, including in this state with all the anti-gun groups and Chris Murphy and everything? What do they say? If it saves just one life, it's worth it. Right? Well, why can't we apply that to immigration? Or are people just too concerned with trying to find somebody to cut their hedges or cut their lawns? Is that what it comes down to? Ibarra was arrested and charged Friday with malice and felony murder, aggravated battery, kidnapping, concealing the death of another, and other charges in connection with the death of the 22-year-old. Now, his, I guess, former wife, they split up. Gee, I wonder why they got married. I wonder why. She couldn't believe it was him. In fact, she says right here, the New York Post interviewed her. Quote, we got married so we could join our asylum cases. That's right. Try and get married because this way, you know, they don't want to split up families because that, my God, would be so unfair. I want to talk to him, she said. I have a lot of faith that this wasn't him. Yeah, okay. That there was a misunderstanding somewhere. But if he did it, he has to pay for what he did truly. Well, good for her for at least having some common sense. Lake and Riley's suspected killer again, Jose Ibarra, illegally entered the U.S. in 2022 and was cut loose due to a lack of detention space. That's another thing. Folks, I'm sorry. But my question to you stands. Are you going to think the same thing if this is your daughter? Because I know that I have them in my circle of friends. Well, you Republicans and you conservatives with immigration, it's just because you hate brown people. No, it's not. And that is stupid when I hear that. What it is we like a process here. And basically, that's why a lot of people, including myself, were not too hot on this immigration bill that got shot down in Congress or is going nowhere, because it still would have led an average of 4,000 to 5,000 people over a stretch into the country. How many Jose Ibarras would have been in there? And I know we have a lot of our own homegrown criminals. I get that. But the bottom line is this. If we had a real policy on migration and immigration, and the real guts to say, no, turn around, you can't come in. Unless you're claiming asylum, you can't cross here in El Paso. Go away. I know that's hard to say. This young woman would likely have been alive. And we have people out there saying, oh, no, well, we can't. Oh, my God, this is horrible. We can't use this for political purposes. You're damn sure we can. Damn straight we can. So I can't wait. You know what? Now, I don't know how Joe Biden goes down to the border this week and blames this on Republicans when he all of a sudden, and he's going to go down there and he's going to be asked questions if he's with it enough to answer questions. All of a sudden now he's determining that he wants to issue some executive orders to turn more illegals away. Well, wait a minute, Mr. President. With all due respect, sir, why didn't you do that from day one when you came into office? Why did you not do that and instead, you know, pandering like all get out, reverse a lot of the stuff that, frankly, to a lot of a great extent was working during the Trump years? Listen, say what you want about Donald Trump, but, you know, you look at the numbers. I know people say it was COVID. Yeah, all right, whatever. It is mind-numbing. And look, I hope when Trump goes down there, and I don't doubt he won't, I want to see him drop the hammer on Biden on this, figuratively, of course, and the White House and Democrats. And they're all going to scurry and run, and they're all going to, Chris Murphy and Dick Blumenthal and Rosa DeLauro and Jim Himes, everybody's going to start throwing a tantrum. I can't believe Trump said that. Well, too bad. Too bad, kids. Dave in Meriden's here. Dave, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Paul. Hey, I'm not against brown people. I'm against lowlifes, deadbeats, and criminals coming into this country.
Yeah.
That's all. Very simple. You know, if you want to, you know, live the right way and do it the right way, come in the way you should come in, and then, you know, everything will be fine.
Dave, how many Jose Ibarras do you think that we are letting into this country who have not done evil deeds yet that have the potential to do it? Come on.
Yeah. Well, look at that girl a couple of years back in California. Remember the one who was shot?
Yes.
And this guy had been deported something like five times.
Five times, yeah.
Yeah. And here he is, back in the country again.
Yeah.
I mean, what's wrong with this picture?
You know, Dave, thank you for the call. Here's what's wrong with it. They know they can get away with it. That's what it is. There's nothing wrong as far as they're concerned, but the wrong, in air quotes, is that we allow it to happen. Because we say, oh, come on, come across the Rio Grande. Watch that rock. It's a little slippery. I don't know, that whole problem-solving thing, I got to get that taken out of my contract. I don't know. I mean, they hired me to just flap my gums, but solving problems, I don't know. Maybe I could hire our next guest here, our buddy, our pal, Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation, going to talk about the Supreme Court. Maybe Mike can do that. Mike, do you do any contract law? Can you have stuff taken out of my contract? Is that possible?
I don't know about solving all the problems of Connecticut. That's a pretty big bite, Paul.
Yeah.
If there's any man to do it, it's certainly you.
I went to like page 38 of my contract one day, and they said, "Whoa, what's this in here?" Anyway, but I had to keep it in there. They would have cut me off from the coffee machine.
That might get voided out for overbroadness.
That's right. You see, I knew you'd go an overly broad aspect of the contract. Thank you, Your Honor. Mike O'Neill's here, Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org. Mike, what's going on with the Supreme Court and another case, even though nothing really ever changes with these people, another case involving social media networks? Fill us in here.
Right. So the Supreme Court heard today long oral arguments, I mean, multiple hours, really two cases that were consolidated into an oral argument today. NetChoice versus Paxton, Moody versus NetChoice, and these involve the laws enacted by Florida and Texas, respectively. These are state enacted laws that govern usage of social media. Essentially, what they said is that social media companies, if you remember a few years ago, there was a lot of uproar about social media, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, shadow banning conservative voices. Right?
Yeah.
There was the anti-vax movement that was shadow banned. There was election issues that were suppressed on Facebook and on Twitter at the time. So in response to this, the state legislatures enacted the laws saying that you cannot ban these entities. You have to give them free rein. You have to give free rein to anybody on your platform to speak. Well, the contrary argument, the other side of this, is the social media companies said, well, we have to have editorial control over this. If we don't have editorial control over this, it's going to be a forum for terrorists or for bomb makers or scary stuff. And so we're inundated with all of this stuff. We need to retain editorial control. So it's really the tension here between those two sorts of things. So essentially what it came down to today was oral argument here is, and it implicated the First Amendment, right? Now, the First Amendment deals with the free speech here. And the social media companies argue, they say, we have a First Amendment right to control, an editorial right to control the content on our platform.
Mm-hmm.
Akin to the New York Times, for example. That's what they were trying to say. They're trying to say, we are like the New York Times. We are a content provider. We have to retain editorial discretion. And therefore, because we have these editorial, we function as an editor and in this capacity, we have First Amendment protections. And therefore, laws you pass that say we have to give free rein to this interferes with our First Amendment rights.
Mm.
And on, go ahead.
No. Go ahead, Mike, please, because I do have a question.
So on the other side of,
but you may answer it. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. On the other side of the equation, the state legislatures argue, no. You guys aren't functioning as newspapers. You guys are functioning as a town square. You're functioning as common carriers. And that means you can't discriminate on the basis of who has access to providing content for your basis. And what they say is, so the states are trying to pull you into this. First Amendment protections are not applicable because you aren't exercising these editorial decisions. You are functioning as a town square, and you can't discriminate on that basis. So, for example, if you're in a shopping mall, you can't discriminate on – you can't say to conservatives, hey, conservatives, you can't come into my shopping mall to distribute flyers – and hey, not conservatives, you guys are allowed to come in. So if that's it's really the tension there. The advocates for the states are trying to say, hey, these platforms are functioning as common carriers or digital town squares. On the other side of the equation, the social media platforms are arguing that no, we are exercising editorial authority here. We need to be able to govern who posts what on our websites.
And Mike, you did actually touch on that, and I guess maybe this will tie into it. I guess the best way that I've read so far, Mike, to understand this is somebody earlier today on some network said, think of the social media platform, or at least one side of the argument is, they're the phone company. Like, they just provide the connection. They really have no say, unless law enforcement comes in with a subpoena. They have no say as to what caller A says to caller B.
Exactly. And actually, that's an interesting point, because they delved into that in oral arguments here, too. The justices were really sussing out the extent to which the social media companies were asserting this authority. Now, for example, Justice Alito asked a question, well, hey, does Google have the authority to censor IM messages? Mm. If you use Gmail, for example, can Google censor Gmail? Can Google ban you on the content of your email that you might send between private communications between the two of them? And the advocate for Google, for the tech companies, for the social media companies, said, well, yes, the again, this is editorial discretion. Perhaps maybe went a little far with that, and that triggered, you know, a host of active questions from the panel. Whoa, extent to which, how far are we willing to go here? I mean, you could see it. Perhaps you can kind of conceptualize it from a newsfeed standpoint, from maybe an X or a Facebook newsfeed standpoint. But really, are you functioning in a capacity as an editorial if you're getting into banning individuals for the basis of their email communication? Well, this also raises kind of a legalistic point, Paul, that I think really bears discussion and just a little bit of discussion, because it might be imperative to the ultimate outcome in the short term here. This, bear with me for a second as I explain this. This is a facial challenge to the Texas and Florida laws. This is not an as-applied challenge. So what we have here is we don't have a robust factual record. The entities, the social media companies, the tech companies that are challenging these laws are challenging the laws as they were passed. There has been no actual applicable factual scenario whereby, for example, Mike O'Neill is pushing I'm publishing stuff on Facebook, for example. Facebook bans me because they don't like what I'm putting out on my Facebook feed, and I sue Facebook for violating my First Amendment rights. That would be an as-applied challenge. Right now, there is not a robust factual record of how this is actually all going to play out in practice, because these challenges were initiated the moment the laws were passed. Now, let me tell you why that's important, is because it means that there is a lower standard necessary for these states to succeed in their laws. In other words, the state, the First Amendment protections that we talked about might not necessarily attach in every single instance in this law, and therefore courts have to say, okay, well, because it doesn't attach in every single instance in this law, there's a legitimate purpose. We're going to have to say the law is good for right now. So that might be an off-ramp that the court engages in.
Interesting. And Mike, whenever we talk about this, you and I, or I'm talking about it on my show, or our morning host, and she does a lot of interviews regarding this, it's interesting that there's this notion that, well, social media and the internet is kind of the town square. And I kind of get that. But, you know, pre-like 1990, back when the internet was, you know, there was no social media, the internet was still expanding. I mean, if somebody was a nut in the town square and was just spewing some idiocy on a soapbox, you know, at lunchtime, people would say, yeah, this guy again, and walk away. Now you can spew perfectly good things or crazy things, and with the touch of a button, it could be all over the world. I mean, that's to me.
That's the point that Justice Kagan raises, and she raised that repeatedly during oral arguments today. And again, these are the issues that the court is struggling with right now. This is a new. These are all. We live in interesting times, Paul. These are all cases where you try to analogize to cases that the court, you know, how jurisprudence works, Supreme Court jurisprudence. You try to analogize it to cases that existed before, and you try to draw the case before you try to draw your decisions based on that. So that is, that is certainly a factor for the court to consider. Again, here, we always get to how this is going to suss out. And again, you always have to know that when free speech is at play here, the Supreme Court is always going to rule if you can get into that realm of First Amendment protections attached. The court has been really consistent over the years in saying, hey, if this implicates if the state is acting to implicate the First Amendment rights of a private party, in this case, you know, the private tech companies, then I think the likelihood of success for those tech companies is higher. Yeah. However, I do think really that this as-applied versus facial challenge kind of nuance here is going to factor into the ultimate decision. And this might just be a temporary decision where the court says, hey, right now, you can't say definitively that every section of these Florida and Texas laws violates the First Amendment rights of the tech companies. Therefore, we're going to have to sign off and say that it's okay for right now. But if you can show, as applied, in a factual case, that these social media companies' First Amendment rights are being implicated by these laws passed by Texas and Florida, then you're going to have another case. So it's going to be really interesting. It's complicated, but I think it's interesting times for what we're working on here.
Great stuff. Mike O'Neill. Mike, thank you. Check him out, Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org. Mike, as always, we appreciate the explanation. Thank you, sir.
Take care, Paul. You have a great day.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Well, there you go, trying to explain it as best he can there. All righty, we'll get back to open phones, do our news digest later on in the show, stuff you may have missed, some interesting stuff from the weekend, in particular with the South Carolina primary. Now it's pretty much over. You have Super Tuesday coming up. You have one of the Koch brothers, or the surviving Koch brother, pulling his financial support from Nikki Haley. You have Lara Trump taking over the Republican Party. Oh, man. Here to wallow in all of this with us is Terry Cowgill, Substack.com, and the Connecticut News Junkie.com. Mr. Cowgill, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, well, not bad, thank you. I got out and enjoyed some of the nice spring weather. Took a nice long walk, and it felt great.
Nice. I'm going to do that as soon as I'm done. I'm going to put the jacket on, put the scarf on, and go out tonight. I usually do it in the morning, Terry, but today I was jammed up. So, yes, my kind of nights here. You wanted to talk a lot about here. First of all, interesting, Governor Lamont, number one, people are starting to wonder, Terry, is he going to run again? And he's in his early 70s, so that's interesting. And number two, our buddy, our pal Kevin Rennie had pointed out, I guess you could say a little inconsistency from the governor recently that kind of makes you say to yourself, you know, Ned, you're so smart on a lot of things, but this one might have been a misstep.
Yeah, well, he made, I guess Rennie's point was that, you know, Lamont, you may remember when he first burst on the scene in terms of the political landscape. It was 2006, mm-hmm. and he was an insurgent, and he was a Democrat. He challenged the incumbent, Joe Lieberman, for the nomination to become, you know, Connecticut's next U.S. senator. He was really torqued off about Lieberman's embrace of the George Bush's Iraq War,
mm-hmm.
and he ran really as an outsider. And that became part of his identity. And now, according to Rennie, and I agree with him largely on this, he's playing the role of consummate insider because he's done some things lately that really just kind of smack of being like a lifelong government hack, you know. And it's been very, I think, depressing to look at. And because it all stems from, as Rennie says,
yeah.
Replacing this fellow on the State Contracting Standards Board. And, of course, that board had raised a lot of issues about the contracts for the cost of the State Pier Project in New London, which was just a disaster.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, that board has been a thorn in the side of lots of people. So Bob Rinker is a former union activist, a labor leader, was on that board. And Lamont sort of unceremoniously fired him. And even board members said that they just thought they were horrified by this because they didn't see any reason for it. So, you know, there was that move. And then, of course, Lamont refused to appoint the top choice of the prison overboard site. And this fellow was going to be an independent authority to oversee the Department of Correction. The board wanted Ken Krajewski,
mm-hmm.
who I've known Ken for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's a very passionate, he's an attorney, very passionate defender of you know, making sure the incarcerated people are fairly treated. And Lamont didn't want him, wanted somebody else. I forget exactly who he appointed, but certainly would not have been somebody who would have been as forceful as Krajewski. You know, he just wouldn't deal with that stuff anymore. And the worst part about it, as Rennie points out, is then, you know, he goes last Tuesday and he takes the time to, as Rennie says, give a warm embrace to Joseph Ganim. Okay.
Well,
so, I mean, I suppose he has to do that as the incumbent Democratic governor. But man, you know, he had some harsh things to say about Ganim in 2018 when he ran against him for governor.
You know,
so it's been depressing to look at.
Yeah, and Terry, I kind of like in this, and I have a lot of pro-Trump people that listen to this show, and I'll admit I voted for him for the first two times, likely not to happen again. But it's interesting when people say, when they try to be outsiders, Terry, right, drain mm-hmm. the swamp or they don't want, and then they get in office and they figure out, geez, I may be in the big office or the big chair, but I'm one guy. And you look around, and yeah, I spent all my money and I got elected, but the swamp kind of runs the place. You know what I mean, Terry? It's like, oh boy, here I am, this outsider. And then by like week three, you realize, okay, if I got rid of everybody, then I'd be the only guy in the building, you know?
Well, yeah, and what I think happens is, I mean, you could become part of the swamp, certainly. I suspect what happens, and I know people who were in some high places in government, mm-hmm. and they tell me that, you know, you walk in, whether it's the White House or the, the governor's offices and in the Capitol, the executive offices, you get a job working in one of those environments, and it is just intoxicating. You know, walk through the corridors of power, and mm-hmm. you know, there's all of this important stuff. There's portraits of all the past office holders, and there's people around to do your bidding. You have people, is the phrase, and it just becomes, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It becomes intoxicating. It becomes like a drug. You get addicted to it, and you just don't want to lose that. And then you become accustomed to all the ways that the establishment does business, and you just become a part of it. So, yeah. I agree with you. You become part of the problem. And that appears to be the problem with Lamont. Although now my question is, and of course that could segue into something else,
sure.
but I mean, is he going to run for re-election? I don't think it's too early to speculate at this point.
No.
What do you think?
No, well, you know, number one, he looks a lot better since he stopped coloring his hair. I think he actually looks younger. He looks better. You know, he's in his early 70s, Terry, right? He looks good. Mm-hmm. He seems to have the energy. And, I mean, we don't know. Is two terms enough? And then what happened? And you wonder, you know, Terry, I was thinking about this. His legacy would be, obviously, and I know there are the gun issue and the abortion issue, but whatever, it's a blue state. I think he would really want his legacy to be that, hey, I tamed as best I could, right, the financial bear of this state. I was able to do the guardrail thing. By the way, that's a new game, Terry. Drink when you hear the word guardrails.
Yeah, but fiscal guardrails.
yes. But I think he really takes pride in that, and I wonder if he'd go for one more term, because my gut feeling on this, Terry, I think that whomever the Democrats might elect after him is probably going to be far to the left of him. And I wonder if Ned wants another, what it would be, 6 years, the remaining plus two more, to say, hey, I really want to get this straight. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because I look at some of the people who might be running, and of course, for the Democratic nomination, and you look at the list of constitutional officers. You had mentioned Susan Bicewicz, mm-hmm. and she's a logical choice to run, but she's a lieutenant governor. I don't know. I argue that they should abolish the position, because the lieutenant governor has no official duties at all, and they could be assigned elsewhere to staff. Mm-hmm. I've argued this for a long time. In fact, Massachusetts went without a lieutenant governor for more than a year in like 2014, mm-hmm. 2013, 2014. They went without a lieutenant governor for more than a year, and no one even noticed. So I think you could definitely change that. But, you know, you have other people like, I'm sure Sean Scanlon, the controller, he's very ambitious.
Yeah.
He might run. Eric Russell, the treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
You see Tong, though, as running for Senate and not governor, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I just think it's that natural attorney general trampoline, Joe Lieberman, Dick Blumenthal, William Tong. Yeah. It's a law firm. It flows off the lips right there. Yep.
Lieberman, Blumenthal, and Tong.
Can I help you?
That.
Can
good.
I help you? Yeah. Terry, in the minutes we have left, I wanted to talk about your Substack piece. Interesting, and I've talked about this over and over. You know, Donald Trump, and I'm going to talk about this to wrap up the show later, but he cruised to victory, 20 points. It's all but over. He's going to control the RNC. And you talk about his attitude toward Russia, and we can talk about that with Ukraine. And I just think, Terry, he is so laser focused, more than probably Richard Nixon or Dwight Eisenhower, or even Ronald Reagan. The base. And the GOP base, Terry, I can tell you from hanging around with these people and being friends with them and on discussion boards, it is more further right than I ever recall. It's maddening.
Well, it is. And, you know, interestingly enough, all of these prosecutions and lawsuits have had the effect of making his core group of supporters even more fervent and perhaps even more radicalized, because not only does the swamp need to be drained, but the swamp is actively working against Trump and trying to put him in jail. And I could see that attitude a mile away, and I knew that it was going to happen when the lawsuit started and the indictments came down. And I fear that that's going to happen. And of course, I mean, he could be reelected.
Tell
my progressive friends, Joe Biden's approval ratings are 38%. I believe was the last time I looked. Now Trump's aren't much better, but no president's ever been reelected with 38% approval ratings. It's almost a statistical impossibility. They would just have to hope that the polls aren't right.
Yeah, and Terry, the media says, and you and I watch the news channels. I keep one on here in particular to get the other side of things during the day. And once the polls start to shift, when is that going to be? I mean, we have all these high-profile trials. And Terry, if anything, again, I said it before I started the show with this. This is tragic what happened to that nursing student down at UGA there. But you know what's going to happen when Trump goes to the border on Thursday and Biden's there the same day? He is going to pile drive this issue, and it's going to have the White House back on their heels again. You just know it.
Well, it will. Of course, there is a border bill, a bipartisan border bill that could be passed and Biden would sign it. I think the Democrats do have that issue to run against, is that, they were handed this bill that even the Border Patrol Union has endorsed, and they won't pass it because Donald Trump wants the issue to run on against Biden. So, Democrats could use that to their advantage. But in general, if you're not a Trump fan, as I'm not, it's not a great time politically, because I fear that if he doesn't win, of course, he's not going to accept the results. And we're going to we'll be dragged through this whole thing again with the election being a fraud and rigged, and there will be lawsuits. They'll come up with crazy. You thought his lawyers were bad in 2020. Wait until you see the lawyers that he hires to contest the election of 2024 if he loses.
And just think,
that
Terry.
That will be a clown show.
Oh, and, yeah. Terry, just think. The big controversy in the latter part of the George H.W. Bush years, and it may have cost him, he was fascinated with a supermarket scanner. You remember that?
I do remember that.
God.
Yeah, he acted as if he'd never seen one. And it became an avatar for him being completely out of touch, and a rich guy up in Kennebunkport
who had
servants, and yeah, that was bad for him. These moments, there are certain moments that are etched indelibly in your memory. Like, depends on what the definition of is.
And of course, waving the bony finger in our face. I did not have sex with that woman.
Yes. Oh, exactly. And I can still see him wagging his finger. It's a perfect segue for the intoxication of power. He didn't want to give it up. I know that much. Bill
no,
didn't.
No. Terry Cowgill. Terry, thanks. Good to chat with you. We'll talk with you next week. Thank you, sir.
All right. Very good.
Appreciate it.